The Sandline Affair, Bougainville, 1997. This is actually a personal story, and I was a bit reluctant to include it. However, this is not in Melanesian stories, and as far as I know, the story has not been published anywhere else. It is an important part of Bougainville history, and the story is worth telling. So, with some reluctance, here I go. The story is part of a memoir that I did, an oral history project I did with the help of Brother Des Murphy some years ago, where Des was asking me some questions about my life, really. But this particular bit is about Bougainville in 1997. Des began by asking me the question, "So you were not in any way anxious over those 2 or 3 years that you were there in Bougainville?" And here is my response. "There were some adventures for sure. I'd been there only a month or so when the PNG government hired a group of mercenaries from the United Kingdom, the Sandline mercenaries, the so-called Sandline Affair. The plan was that these mercenaries were to set themselves up in Bougainville in a secret location and hunt down all the revolutionaries to end the war once and for all. That was the plan. Francis Ona, who is an ex-student of the Marist Brothers from Kieta, was the leader of the BRA and the self-proclaimed president of the independent state of Mekamui. As a result of the Sandline announcement, Francis Ona announced on Radio Free Bougainville that any white people seen on Bougainville will be shot on sight. He said, "I authorize my army to shoot on sight any white people who we see anywhere on the island of Bougainville." Besides the two of us, that's Ken MacDonald and myself, the only other expats on the island at the time were a small handful of Australian government people, AusAid, who were doing some work in the northern part of the island. There were also a couple of elderly Marist priests living in isolated villages who had spent their entire active ministry on Bougainville. The AusAid bloke came around to see us at home that night. That's the night that Francis Ona announced he's going to shoot us all. He explains the situation and says, "Tomorrow morning a helicopter has been organised to evacuate the remaining Australians. So you be at Booker Airport at this time. The flight will take you to Rabaul, where everything is safe, and from there you're on your own. You organise your own ticket back to Australia." Somewhat reluctantly, Ken and I agreed to that plan. We packed our bags, and then we had a conversation with the principal of the school, Bishop Wade High School, Bernadette Roper, and other locals, and said, "What do? We want to stay, but is it going to be too dangerous?" We asked our boys, the students. Now, these were ex-BRA boys, and they knew these fighters who'd been given the commission to shoot all the white people. And the boys actually said, "Brother, we're not sure, but if they come, we don't think we can control them. We're not sure what they will do. Perhaps it's best if you go." And that's why it became a bit tricky. We did not want to put the local people at risk if they tried to protect us. I was the new boy on the scene. I'd been on the island a matter of weeks. Ken had been there some years, so was in a much better position to advise on how we should proceed. We again consulted Bernadette Roper. She said, "I'm not sure. You make the call." So Ken and I said, "Okay, perhaps we should go." Our reason for, I'm just leaving the reading for a minute. Our reason for that agreement is mainly because of the uncertainty of the local people. They were saying that they weren't sure what these rebels would do, and that they would possibly not be able to control them, even though they probably knew many of them. So it was out of respect for the opinion of the locals that we agreed that we, at that point, we should leave the island, but we were not in any way comfortable about it. I'll now resume from the reading of the memoir. Some hours later, I'm in my room. I'm packing up a few final things. Ken comes in and sits on the bed and says, "I'm staying." He said, "I can't leave these people. I'm not going to go." He said, "You can go if you want, but I'm not going to go." So straight away I said, "If you're not going, I'm not going either. That's it." So that was that. Decision final. So we went back to Bernadette Roper to inform her of this decision. And then the locals were delighted that we'd decided to stay with them. Bernadette put into place some contingency plans. She found some families who had good hiding places, so if something happened, we could be secreted away and put in some safe place where no one would find us. So we stayed on Bougainville. Next day, we went to school as normal. We taught on. Not much happened. Some days later, Francis Ona gets back on Radio Free Bougainville and says, "Actually, we're only going to shoot the mercenaries and any government people, the Ozaid. We never meant the missionaries. We never meant the priests. We never meant the sisters. We never meant the brothers. You are welcome. You are welcome to stay in Mekamui." The other aspect of the story is that this news floated back to Australia. Communications between Bougainville Island and anywhere else in the world are pretty much impossible at that time. So my family and my friends here in Australia, having heard the news reports, are extremely agitated about what is happening. And they tried all kinds of methods, ringing the government and ringing all sorts of people to try to find out what the hell is going on in Bougainville and to see whether we are safe. Eventually, days later, I was able to get to a working phone on Booker Island, and I was able to ring my family on a very scratchy line to inform them of what we were doing, that we were in fact safe. And just to continue, I could talk for hours about the war, but we mustn't lengthen this unnecessarily. But we would quite often encounter BRA people. One morning early, an armed platoon of BRA walked into the dormitory at Chirigay, where the boys are. Of course, they knew many of the boys, because many of our boys had been fighting with them. So Ken is there negotiating with them. "All we want is for them to go, take their guns away, go and do what they have to do, but to leave the school alone, you know. You have to be ever so careful because these boys have killed many people. They're dangerous people." Mind you, our own students had killed people and perhaps were guilty of war atrocities themselves. Certainly they'd suffered war atrocities and were suffering the effects of trauma. Eventually, given quite a few bags of rice and lots of clothing from the boys and other food, we were able to convince the BRA platoon to leave. They disappeared back into the jungle. On other occasions, we're driving a vehicle on the road heading north. BRA boys stop us and say, "Can you take us down to such and such a place?" And they'd all pile into the back of the truck and we'd have to drive them down. So there were often roadblocks by the BRA or roadblocks by the PNG Defence Force. So, yes, they were interesting times. At that point, Des asked me, "How did that end up with the Sandline affair?" Very interesting. It was a significant event, actually, this little bit of history, because what happened was that the police and some army people and a lot of civilians took over the Parliament House in Port Moresby. And they held captive all the politicians, saying, "You can't do this to our people. These are Papua New Guineans. They're Bougainvillians, yes, but they are Papua New Guineans." Bougainvillians generally don't have great trust for the mainland as a PNG, referring to them as redskins, as Bougainvillians have extremely black skin. On this occasion, however, the redskins did the right thing and insisted that the government stop this nonsense. Julius Chan, the Prime Minister of the time, was forced out of office. He lost his job. In fact, the Sandline mercenaries had never landed on Bougainville, and after that, they never did. So the Sandline affair ended politically and rather dramatically.